there on the third floor fills up pretty fast. So the event is at 7:30. I would get there at 7 and have a cup of coffee, browse the books. Anyway, Nick Terse is here. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks so much for having me on today.
Well, tell me, this book is sort of an account of, it's just a compendium of atrocities that our military committed in Vietnam. And tell us how you got all this evidence. You were into the archives, right?
Yeah. You know, I really stumbled upon this project. I never intended to write a book on U.S. atrocities in Vietnam or Vietnamese civilian suffering, but when I was a graduate student, I was working on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among Vietnam veterans, and it was my job to go down to the National Archives to find hard data, official records to mm-hmm. match up to the interviews that we had to place veterans at a specific time and place during the war. And on one of these research trips, I just hit one brick wall after another, one dead end after another in my research, and finally, after 2 weeks, it was my last day in the archives, and I went to an archivist that I knew, and I said, look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. I need something, at least a lead, mm-hmm. or he's never going to let me back down here again. And the archivist thought about it for, you know, I'd say all of 5 seconds, and then he asked me a question that ended up changing my life. He said, do you think that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress? And I said, you know, that's an excellent hypothesis. What do you have on war crimes? And he told me about a group of files called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group Files. This was a group of records assembled by a secret Pentagon task force. It operated out of the Army Chief of Staff's office, and it was put together in the wake of the My Lai massacre scandal. The Army wanted to make sure that it was never caught flat-footed by a scandal again, and so it tracked all the war crimes allegations that came to its attention. These were records that detailed massacres, murder, rape, torture, assault, mutilation, horrific crimes, and I realized very quickly that that these records weren't anywhere in the historical literature, mm-hmm. and that kind of set me on the path that led to this book.
How many were there? I mean, do you have any idea? Total hundreds, thousands?
There were 800 reports of war crimes in this collection. Mm-hmm. 300 of them substantiated by the Army, the other ones basically closed without almost any investigation done at all. What the Army set this task force up for was not to investigate war crimes, to prosecute war crimes, to put guidance into the field to avoid war crimes. The idea of the group was to track cases and then, whenever they could, to tamp them down. So many times they would just kill an investigation and it would disappear. And they sat, in an Army warehouse and then the archive shelves for decades without anyone ever seeing them.
Wow. Well, let's talk about My Lai. Was that one of the? Well, that's the one example of a war crime that most people are aware of. If they're aware of anything at all about Vietnam, but
yeah, it is the one case that people do know about. It took place on March 16th, 1968. 500 Vietnamese civilians were killed by elements of the 23rd Infantry Division mm-hmm. Over a period of 4 hours, during which time U.S. troops even took a break to eat their lunch in the midst of this carnage. Mm-hmm. In addition to killing all those civilians, they raped women, mm-hmm. young girls, mutilated bodies, burned down the village, fouled the area's water supply. They really just totally destroyed the entire hamlet.
Mm. And Lieutenant William Calley was, as far as I know, was the only one who was court-martialed for that, right?
He was the only one that was convicted. When the Army investigated it, they found that there were 228 offenses that were committed by everyone from low-level troops on the ground all the way up to generals at the top of the division. Calley, who had no shortage of blood on his hands, I should say, he was made to bear the brunt of and shoulder all the blame, as if one man could kill 500 civilians. Mm-hmm. It was actually carried out by dozens of men from the unit under orders from higher officers, and there were high-ranking officers, colonels, that were flying overhead who could see exactly what was going on that day. Mm-hmm. But the military let most of these people go. There were a few other trials, but none of them led to convictions. And Calley, although he was convicted, he only served 3 years, and most of that under house arrest, and that was because of the intervention of President Richard Nixon.
Yeah, house arrest. Like he was, this was a, he. Last I heard, he was. I guess I don't know if he's still alive now, but last I heard, he was a manager of a jewelry store in Columbus, Georgia, or something like that.
Yeah, that was his job for years after, unless he's recently retired. That still is his job, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, he did come out and express some remorse for the crimes at My Lai.
Really?
Which is, mm-hmm. I mean, it's more than anyone else affiliated with that, mm-hmm. other than some low-ranking troops below him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's atypical in that regard, but it did take him close to 40 years to voice it.
Then I remember above him there was this Captain Medina. Now, was he ever put on trial? He sort of...
Medina was court-martialed, but, mm-hmm. He was never convicted of any crime.
Mm-hmm.
And then the night before the massacre, Medina held a briefing, and he was asked at that briefing, the men who were there said, that one of them asked, what should we do with women and children that we find? And his response was, kill everything that moves.
So that's where that quote comes from. Well, that one quote comes from a lot of different people.
Yeah, I found, the title of mine is slightly different. It's kill anything that moves. Mm-hmm. But I found that quote and variations thereof used in many different incidents. I started seeing it as a shorthand for how the war was fought, mm-hmm. and it was uttered by many officers from different units at different times in the war in different places in Vietnam. And I began to see that this was a standard operating procedure for troops on the ground.
Well, I think that happened in the Army. I did 3 years in the Army, and you find there's certain phrases get used an awful lot.
Yeah.
I didn't run across that one when I was in, but, well, that's sort of, in your book, you talk about how this, it was not an aberration, it was an operation.
Yeah, that was...
And it came down from above. I mean, there are reasons for this kind of wanton killing.
Yeah, I try to make clear in the book that this isn't, as it's often been portrayed in the history of the war, not the work of rogue troops, not an isolated incident, not bad apples. Most of the killing that went on in Vietnam was not face-to-face massacres like My Lai.
Mm-hmm.
It was the application of heavy firepower on densely populated civilian areas, and this was a direct result of command policy that made this possible. It's not the troops on the ground. It's the generals in Saigon and the generals back at the Pentagon.
Well, what were the reasons for that policy?
Well, there's Vietnam was fought. It wasn't a conventional war like World War I or World War II, where you had armies that faced off over a defined battlefield. The U.S. was never trying to take territory. They weren't trying to capture an enemy's capital. But the military, the Pentagon, was looking for some metric to show that they were making progress. What they settled on was the body count, the idea being that you could kill your way to victory, basically, that you would kill enough Vietnamese that the enemy would finally throw up its hands and sue for peace. They saw this as what a rational opponent would do. It was a complete misreading of Vietnamese history.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnamese had fought the Chinese for on and off for a millennia to gain their independence. They'd fought the Japanese during World War II. They'd fought the French, who tried to reimpose their colonial rule after the war. And that effort was bankrolled by the U.S., about 80% of it. So, the Vietnamese weren't going to just fold on account of losing enemy forces. They were committed to this fight. So the U.S. was always searching for this elusive crossover point where they'd be killing more Vietnamese than they could put into the field.
Mm-hmm.
They never reached that, but they never came up with another plan for victory. They just kept on with the body count, and what they did was just increase the firepower on populated areas, and troops on the ground realized very quickly that their commanders didn't care who those bodies belonged to. It didn't matter if you turned in bodies and there were no weapons to show for it. Your mm-hmm. commanders didn't ask questions because they were being leaned on by their superiors to produce bodies. So no one was going to second guess or think twice about this.
How many Vietnamese were killed in this war?
Well, we'll never know for sure. The best estimates that we have are, and this was put together a few years ago by scientists at Harvard Medical School and University of Washington. They came up with a total of 3.8 million Vietnamese, combatants and non-combatants. The best estimates that we have say about 2 million of those Vietnamese were civilians. Add to that, over 5 million were wounded, according to our best estimates. 11 million made refugees, and that's according to U.S. government figures. 4 million or so exposed to toxic defoliants like Agent Orange. The scale of the suffering is immense, almost unimaginable.
As opposed to, I think we lost something like 68,000.
58,000 and
plus,
change.
Plus, however, many were wounded.
About 150,000 wounded, badly enough to be hospitalized, 300,000 wounded overall. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the monument in Washington, D.C., when you go there, it does look immense for 58,000, but imagining it at the
about 100 of them or something.
Yeah, 100 times at least.
Oh, my. Well, you say that this was a different kind of a war. You know, World War One and Two, which are wars of position. Even Korea was kind of a war of position.
Right.
So this was, in a way, I think this is our first guerrilla war, unless you want to go back to the Philippine insurrection of 1900. But so this is guerrilla war that we were fighting, and it was the first of who knows how many since then. You know.
Yeah, this was, you're right, the first time since the Philippines insurrection and the Indian Wars in the American West. And the troops on the ground there, they certainly weren't prepared for this. They didn't receive special training for fighting a guerrilla conflict. They weren't given the tools necessary, and they weren't given instruction on how to protect civilians.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of this, you had 18, 19, 20-year-old American boys who were thrust into exceptionally alien environments. And I interviewed hundreds of Vietnam veterans in preparing this book. And they would tell me about what it was like to go into a village, and even though it was filled with only women and children, to be exceptionally scared. You hit a booby trap on the way in or the way out. There are no military-age men around because they know better than to stay in the village.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that the women and children there, they were the ones who they would take out their anger and their frustration on.
This is Per Fagerheim, and we're doing a special show. We're interviewing Nick Terse, who wrote this book, Kill Anything That Moves, the real American War in Vietnam, and he's going to be at Powell's tonight at 7:30. And as I said before, if you're going to go, get there a little bit early because it might fill up. That little room fills up pretty fast. And, it's interesting because I was in the Army just before Vietnam, and I got out, and I remember the basic training we had. And it was had little to do with any kind of guerrilla warfare.
Right.
You know, it was, and I never did get into the advanced infantry stuff. You know, I got into different occupation and everything. But, the training was basically hiking and living in pup tents and, I don't know, digging foxholes. You know, or bayonet drill, which is the most idiotic thing I could think of. But I could see these guys were not prepared, and they were draftees, most of them.
Yeah, many draftees, and I was told over and over again that they weren't trained for the rigors of guerrilla warfare or the protection of civilians, but what they received loud and clear was indoctrination that helped to dehumanize the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them told me that as soon as they got to boot camp, they were told, "You never call them Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
You call them," and I apologize for the slurs. Mm-hmm. "You call them gooks or dinks, slants, slopes."
Mm-hmm.
Rice eaters, zips, anything to take away their humanity, anything to make it easier to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed many minority veterans who told me that when they heard this in boot camp, they said they realized right away that this was the same type of racism that they faced back home, and they vowed to themselves that they would never utter these words. But they said you hear it over and over again during basic training, during advanced infantry training, when you get in country, and soon enough they felt as if it was, they were so steeped in it, they found themselves using the words, and then they found themselves treating the Vietnamese as if they were less than human.
Well, I guess they're in a hostile environment. They know it's hostile. And one of the complaints that they made is that you can't tell friend from foe.
That's right.
There's always that element, you know, well, they all look alike anyway, you know, unquote. And so they're in this
a
real horrible position.
Yeah, and really untenable circumstances in many cases. And you mentioned, you know, they would say that everyone did look alike. The guerrillas wore what the Americans called black pajamas, which were basically a black fitting clothes that all the farmers in the countryside also wore, men and women alike, and children. And it got to the point where in many units you just fired on anyone that you saw running in black pajamas. So if it was a guerrilla running away with a rifle, or a woman who was in the field with a farm implement, like a hoe, who was running away, you fired on anyone that moved.
Mm-hmm. Whereas if you see the army coming, the rational thing is to run away like crazy. Get out of there fast.
Exactly right. And but the military used it as a rationale. They said they were taking evasive action. But and this happened not just with troops on the ground, but also with helicopters overhead. It takes a tremendous amount of courage if a helicopter is flying towards you and its machine gun is rattling away to try and stand still. I mean, obviously, you're going to run. And once you run, you were considered fair game.
Wow. Well, like I said, that was the first of many guerrilla wars. And, Iraq was certainly another one. You know, Afghanistan. And you have, you know, well, of course, in Vietnam, the draft actually ended during the Vietnam War.
That's right. And
they had the lottery, and then they just sort of ended the draft.
And went to, right, the all-volunteer force, which we have today.
And the reason for that was?
Well, I mean, by the end of the Vietnam War, within the military, there was a great fear that the institution was crumbling around them. There was so much dissension in the ranks. AWOL rates were through the roof, desertion, the fragging of officers, that is the killing or wounding of officers by their own troops, a lot of racial strife, drug use in Vietnam. And I talked to, in writing this book, many generals who were high-ranking in Vietnam at the time or back at the Pentagon, and they were really afraid that the institution was coming apart at the seams, that the military might actually break, and getting draftees out and having a professional, self-selected force was seen as a way around this. And in many cases, it has been. You know, the other night during the State of the Union address, President Obama mentioned a veteran who had served 10 tours.
That's amazing, yes.
It was astounding. But there have been so many veterans who've served all these tours. You have a minority, a 1% of the population who does all the fighting instead of a democratized force where people within the ranks get fed up and decide that war isn't for them.
So basically, to avoid one kind of a breakdown, they're setting the military up for another kind of a breakdown.
Yeah, you would think, so far the military's held together, but after 10 tours, you wonder how much longer can the men and women hold up.
I've never heard of anyone serving 10 tours before. I heard 4 or 5, and that's considered a lot.
It is.
10 tours. I mean, it's just, well, you studied post-traumatic stress disorder.
I have, and already we've seen with these current wars, tremendous spikes in PTSD, and I can only assume that going forward things are going to get worse. There are going to be a lot of men and women who are going to need care, and of course that's it's also going to be exceptionally costly for this country when that bill needs to be paid and has to be factored into what these wars have cost on the human scale and the economic scale.
Sometimes I wonder if they will pay. You know, they'll try and, in the past, veterans have gotten short shrift after a while.
Yeah, I mean, veterans have always had to fight for, the pay and benefits that they were promised by the military, so... You'd think in a time of economic austerity that we're going to see that again.
And then you have all the suicides too.
Yeah, a lot of suicides and self harm. It's shocking.
Sort of the impression I get is maybe it's just sort of a hunch or a guess or something is that the men and women who take their own lives are the ones who have some kind of conscience. You know, I mean, that, you know, you take any group of people, there's bound to be, you know, if you take 100 people at random, you know, maybe two or three might actually be psychopathic. This right. is just in general. And the Army's no different, you know. And, you know, they're not all brave, wonderful people. They're all kinds of people who are put in a horrible situation.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, would the sort of the psychopathic or the, you know, the mean people, would they be unruffled by killing others? Would they just sort of get through it and go on with their lives?
Well, you know, I in the book I profile one sergeant from Vietnam. He was an old soldier. He had served in China at the end of World War II. Then he did two tours in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been a Marine, but he was kicked out of the Marine Corps. He'd been court-martialed several times. He enlisted in the Army. He went to Vietnam, and he racked up an incredible body count. His commander said he had personally killed 1,500 Vietnamese over a period of four tours.
Oh, wow.
But there were always rumors that swirled around him that that he was killing civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, he was caught. He killed three innocent Vietnamese, planted weapons on their bodies. But his men collected evidence of this. He was court-martialed and convicted, but he never served any jail time. They docked his pay for 6 months. They let mm-hmm. him re-enlist.
Oh, wow.
And he continued to serve in Vietnam for the next 4 years after.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that, you know, by men who served with him, that they, you know, was quote-unquote a stone-cold killer,
mm-hmm.
A remorseless killer. But, you know, he thrived in that environment, and mm-hmm. And he was considered something of a super soldier. And mm-hmm. he taught a lot of young troops how to fight the war his way. So, you know, men like that can excel in wartime.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, people out there in Radio Land, that's what we're doing to people, to our own people, you know. I mean, there's probably a lot of young guys who, if they were state civilians and worked at a, you know, ordinary civilian job, they'd live a fairly normal life. But war does...
It does
makes
harm.
It makes people crazy.
It does. Yeah. And there was another gentleman that it always sticks in my mind. He was young at the time, 19, 20 years old, and he told me about going into a village. They were burning it down, and a woman came up to one of the GIs there and was grabbing on his sleeve and screaming at him, obviously because her home was being burnt down. And he said that this GI pushed the woman off a couple times, and finally, third or fourth time she came back, he took the butt of his rifle and hit her squarely in the nose, broke her nose. There was mm-hmm. blood everywhere. She was screaming. And he said that the GI just walked away laughing. And he said to me, "I guess you know where this story is going." He said that GI was me. And he said, "At the time, I didn't think anything of it. But in the time since, I can't get that image out of my head."
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been suffering with it for the previous, you know, the last 40
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are things that men do when they're 19, 20 years old and don't think anything of it at the time, but
oh, right.
but they'll pay for it psychologically for decades to come.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is what the American taxpayer has been buying all these years, and it's happening in Iraq. You know, you hear these stories, Afghanistan, of mutilating corpses and planting weapons and everything else. But so you've... Is there any now you write for Tom Dispatch also? I mean, if people want to read, do you have a website or anything, or just
NickTurse.com. I make it easy on people, so mm-hmm. you can find my stuff there. But I write for TomDispatch.com, and that's where you can find my latest articles.
Well, you're writing now about how the kind of special ops troops are kind of all over the world.
Yeah, I've been digging into that recently. It's not easy to come up with information because the military plays things close to the vest, but I recently discovered that that Special Operations Forces were active in 134 countries last year. That's 70% of the countries in the world.
My.
At the end of the Bush administration, it was only 60 countries, so it's more than doubled over the mm-hmm. Obama years. So there are people who elected him as an anti-war candidate, at least
mm-hmm.
they thought so. But
it's a different kind of war.
Yeah, this is a tremendous expansion of special ops.
Is there a big expansion in Africa, or is that just my impression?
No, there definitely is. Last year I looked at that intensely, and the expansion in Africa is ongoing and accelerating.
How much do they depend? I mean, they're in this sort of territory and doing what they do. Do they depend? How much do they depend on being supplied and ferried around? Or are they really kind of on their own?
Well, you know, what caused me to begin looking into the expansion in Africa was the fact they're putting in a tremendous logistics system of ground transport and sea transport to a lot of small bases that they use throughout Africa. So I could tell that they were building something big. So they're small and austere conditions, but they're putting in place the infrastructure to expand them, I think, exponentially over the years ahead.
Oh, lily pads?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, you know, it's funny because I've been thinking a lot about with the rising price of oil, and I've talked to people like Michael Clare, you know, that right. You know, the military may find that they can't afford a lot of this kind of warfare, and I wonder how many of these special ops groups are going to get stranded someplace.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're leaning on special ops and on drone warfare because mm-hmm. they see it as a small footprint, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to these big footprint wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, a way to fight wars on the cheap with you know, less infrastructure around. Mm-hmm. But it's still costly, and you know, the U.S. military generally it doesn't shrink. It wherever it goes in, it ends up expanding. So.
Right. No easy way out. Well, yeah. I think we're at the end of our show. I've been talking with Nick Turse, who's the author of Kill Anything That Moves. He'll be speaking tonight at Powell's on Burnside at 7:30. And thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Stay tuned. Always something good on KBOO.
You're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Movin' On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial, and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
Hi, Love Jones here, DJ and producer for La Contessa de la Luna, late-night host of The Confessional. I want to invite you to join her and a cast of tens to the Clinton Street Theater pre-Valentine's Day live show and extravaganza, plus movie. Get ready for Thursday, February 13th, when she takes over the Clinton Street Theater for a live show featuring sing-alongs, talk like Christopher Walken contest, prizes, raffles, audience confessions, and a live performance by La Contessa de la Luna, featuring the KBOO dancers. The live show is followed by the film Dogma, featuring George Carlin and Matt Damon. That's triple the entertainment for one ticket, and all proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's La Contessa and Friends, live on stage Thursday, February 13th, starting at 7 p.m. Tickets on sale now at brownpapertickets.com. Just search for KBOO. See you there.
"15 Days" to KBOO's Winter News and Public Affairs Day for Love of a Better World. Friday, February 14th, Valentine's Day, 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. 15 days.
Coming up next on the Incomparable Radio Zine, Kate Welch interviews co-filmmakers Albert Maysles and Nelson Walker, who are making a film about the people they meet on Trains. Thanks for listening to KBOO, and thanks KBOO members for your generous support. If you are not a member, please go to kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.
The following is an interview with co-filmmakers Nelson Walker and Albert Maysles. I'm Kate Welch. Albert Maysles is a pioneer of direct cinema who, with his brother David Maysles, was one of the first to make nonfiction feature films where the drama of life unfolds as it is without scripts, sets, interviews, or narration. He was in Portland recently with co-filmmaker Nelson Walker. They're working on a documentary about the people who they meet on trains. It happened that in December, I was on the train from Chicago to Portland, the Empire Builder, at the same time as they were on the train filming. Albert Maysles accepted my invitation to come to KBOO, not in December, but on a return trip in January. That gave me some time to watch a few of his best-known films, like Salesman, Gimme Shelter, Grey Gardens, and the Beatles' first U.S. visit. He brought along co-filmmaker Nelson Walker, or maybe Nelson brought Al. Either way, it was a joy to be with them, sharing the mics in a small KBOO production room. I was so lucky to have the opportunity to ask a few questions and feel the Maysles love. So stay tuned and find out what Albert Maysles and Nelson Walker are up to. Maybe we could start out by talking about what you are filming right now.
Yeah. Well, Nelson and I are co-filmmakers, and we're making this film of people that we meet on trains. It's a wonderful opportunity for people when they get on a train to meet people whom they otherwise would never have met. And strangers become friends. And those friends become friends to everybody that watches television. It's a wonderful way of bringing the whole world together so that we have ourselves, all of us,